So what I found more interesting was these two kingdoms, same descendants, you know, they all recognize Elendil as their head. They had not been in contact for a while. All right. So again, that sounds like, because it's actually so hard to imagine. And so that's why it's like, I can listen to this kind of stuff all day because it's so hard to imagine. But this is what happened with the Western and Eastern Roman empires. All right. So, Clifford, we're going to jump into Gondor here.
Okay.
So, just a preference. The annals aspect of this is twice as as intense as Arnor, right? You know, I mean, you read it, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, here's the thing. This is where our historical reference are really going to start jumping off like crazy, or at least mine. I don't know. Hopefully, Clifford, you got some, but... Here, you know, when we start listing all these historical references, is Tolkien ripping these off like how George R. R. Martin did with Game of Thrones? Or is there something else?
Shots fired. No, I think let's take them one by one, but I don't see any of them as being ripped off.
Why not?
Well, I guess I'm kind of the opinion that like any sort of fiction, people have original ideas all the time, but everything is kind of interconnected, especially in our heads, and so like it's contingent on everything is based off of something else in a way.
Yeah,
you know, I think people are like referencing their experience and their history, whether it's conscious or subconscious. It's all part of the thing. Like if anything is truly original, you almost need to relate it to something that you understand to fully perceive it.
Okay. So my take on this, it's very similar to that answer. I would say if you're going to try to write a brief chronological annal, you know, for it to sound legit, of course it's going to have echoes of real stuff in history, right? But here's the key here. For every single thing we're going to reference, there's no one specific exact pinpoint in history like, yep, that's exactly what he's basing this off of. You know, there's multiple, you know, and so that goes back to what you're saying. Like, you're kind of just drawing on implicitly or explicitly, you're just drawing on everything that you kind of know. And again, it's like he's drawing on it because it's like, well, he's trying to make this feel real. So he knows all of history very well. So he's just, you know, throwing it in at random without actually even looking at the history because he's just got it all in his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the line that I've just been quoting like crazy for the past month because I just love it so much. I don't think Mark Twain actually said it because I tried to look it up. It's apparently apocryphal. But anyways, he's got the famous line, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. You know, so it's like, again, that just kind of goes back to this. Like, you know, of course, there's stuff, there's going to be multiple events in history that echo each other. And then Tolkien, you know, he's just kind of summing that up into his thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since I did fire the shots versus Game of Thrones, you know, to take some examples, the Red Wedding itself, if you look up the Massacre of Glencoe, point for point, it's the exact same thing. If you look up the War of the Seven Kingdoms getting dragged in one by one, it's definitely like the chain reaction that started World War One. There, an assassination of Franz Ferdinand started, you know, went from Serbia with Russia in and Austria in, and then Germany got involved, and then France got involved, and then England got involved, and somehow, who was the other one? Turkey got involved somehow? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then versus the whole story in the Seven Kingdoms, you know, when Bran gets thrown out of the tower because he sees a certain pair of twins doing a certain something, you know, then that's the event that, you know, starts igniting all the intrigue and everything. So and then one by one, the kingdoms are all getting dragged in. You know, there's like the free cities of Essos or whatever, and it's like, all right, these are spitting image the Italian cities of the north in the medieval times, you know, like Florence, Milan, you know. It's like there's nothing original there, in my opinion. But but that's my shot fired. We can go on. We can probably go on. That's my argument. I don't know if you got a take on that, give me it.
No, I think I agree. I guess the Game of Thrones ones, I feel like there's enough like remixing, recombination, and variation that I don't see it as literally as you do, maybe.
Right. I don't think there's enough. I think there's like, all right, you can't blatantly, so you change a slight detail, you know, but it's not enough for
me. I think like certain aspects of it have extremely direct parallels, but they're overlaid in a way where it's not just like it's European history for 500 years.
Yeah.
There's like enough like, I guess it's just remixing built in that it's a little more nuanced. But yes, I agree. There's a lot of direct parallels. All
right.
In some ways, I think it's like, as part of the reason I think it was so popular, it was popular for a lot of reasons, but the fact that it was immediately resonant with what people knew about history, just enough that they were able to perceive that history, but not enough that they were able to like exactly follow the events, was like a pretty winning combination.
Right. Well, see, and that's where Lord of the Rings wins it for me, is that it's as authentic as history because he's just got such a working knowledge of it, and he can just spit it out and mush it together like this without specifically, you know, over the top referencing something. Like that's where it's like, that's where you get me. That's where I'm won over, you know. Whereas George R. R. Martin, it's like, okay, people can tell his kind of history, but then he explicitly maps out one event with like a detail or two change, you know, for his story. And I was like, all right, I get what you're doing. Nah. No, it might not even be that. I think I might just more just dislike that I knew it was going to be a terrible ending from, from very far out. I knew it was going to be a bad ending. And then the show was really bad, and I'm not going to read the books. All right, anyways. Let's get into Gondor then. Okay. The war never ceased on their borders. For more than 1,000 years, the Dunedain of the South grew in wealth and power by land and sea, until the reign of Atanar II, who was called Alcorin the Glorious. Yet the signs of decay had already appeared. The high men of the South married late, and their children were few. So with that, it seems like we get about 6 or 7 good kings. That must be a thing. Seventh generation, you know, like for 7 generations good after the big, you know, establishment. Uh-huh. 7, that's got to be, we're talking.
And does this line up with the 8 kings we had in the north before it split?
That's a good question, because I don't think it does. I feel like the southern ones are going to have shorter lifespans, but.
Okay.
Yeah, they have way shorter lifespans. Maybe not way, but shorter lifespans.
Okay. Anyways.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So anyways, we get to this king, Astor. By this point, Minas Anor, so that's Minas Tirith, it's already becoming the summer home for the kings instead of Osgiliath as the year-round capital. So then by the year about 540 of the Third Age, Astor's son wins a great victory against the wild men in the east. Okay, so that's probably, when they say east, what they mean is between Mordor and Mirkwood. So if you got to look at a map, do that. But above Mordor, below Mirkwood, in between there, that's the east. And so he gets the title Romandasil, which means east victor. All right, so alarm bell's going off. First historical reference. You don't have one, right?
No, go for it.
Okay, so this reminded me. And I'm so glad I get to bring this up, because this is such a cool point. So this reminds me of the Romans when they were fighting the Punic Wars, which were against
Carthage.
Yep, Carthage. Okay, so this is like 200 BCs, but there's like three of them. So anyways, the most famous one is the second one, because they face who?
What's his name? With an H.
Yep. He has the elephants
across the mountains. Yeah, I know, I know. Why can't I think of his name? Hadrian?
Close, Hannibal.
Hannibal, that's right.
Hadrian's an emperor in like 100 AD. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, anyways, Hannibal, he's wreaking havoc all around Rome. And so, the only way that they can figure out how to defeat this guy, because they can't even get him out of Italy because his army's so powerful, they just send an army to Africa to attack Carthage itself.
Uh huh.
So then Hannibal has to go back to Carthage to defend it. And so then, by that point, they figured out how to handle his elephants in battle, because that was a huge problem, because the elephants just kept trampling their own Roman soldiers.
Uh-huh.
And so the guy that figures it out, and the guy that leads this battle, and then he actually defeats Hannibal in front, like right in front of Carthage there, he's from the Scipio family. I forget what his real name, what his full name is, because it doesn't matter. Because when he gets this title, when he conquers Carthage, which is in North Africa, right? It's in modern-day Tanzania, Tunis today. Uh-huh. When he conquers it, he gets the title for life. He is called, he's hence known, Scipio Africanus. Mm. Isn't that sick? I think it's one of the coolest things in history. You know, like, because the Romans, they didn't really consider Egypt part of Africa. They mostly just thought of Africa as just the southern coast of the Mediterranean from Egypt westwards, you know? And so it's like Scipio Africanus. What a cool title. So that's what they're doing when they got like the East Victor there, you know?
Nice. Okay.
I'm sure there's been other ones in history. I just can't remember them right off the top of my head. Charlemagne's kind of one, you know? Charles the Great. Because Maine is a variant of Magnus, which is great, but yeah.
Okay.
All right, but then eventually this Ramandasil guy, he gets killed in battle. His son Turumbar, which is clearly a, they read the Turin Turumbar, you know, that sad story. Anyways, he finishes the job and he gains a bunch of territory in the east. After that, we get four ship kings in a row who focus on the navy's superiority, right? One of them takes the name Falastar, which means Lord of Coasts. So bold title. Not as bad as whichever Numenorean king claimed the title Lord of the West. That was pretty bad too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all right. So the next one after this, that one. So the second of these four, I think, he conquers Umbar. So what do we know about Umbar?
That's a city further south down the coast, right?
Right. Right. What was significant in relation to Numenor?
There was an outpost there from when they were originally setting up these bases all over Middle Earth, right?
Right. So when they conquer Umbar, it's mostly ruled by the remnants of the bad Numenoreans who were friends with Ar-Pharazôn.
Oh, gotcha.
This is actually where Ar-Pharazôn landed when he marched a week later to tell Sauron to bow down, and Sauron did.
Okay.
Also, if you play Lord of the Rings Risk, it's the furthest south gold place. It's usually one of my favorite to take over, because in case I have the Violent Storms card, I try to angle it so that people have to cross the sea to attack me, and then I destroy their whole army. Shout out to everybody that has lost doing that. All right. Nice. Okay. So, we heard it in Arnor, but they made a reference to the Fjordwaith. So Ford is some sort of word for north, because Fjordwaith are just like Northmen. Because down here, then you see Haradwaith, which means Southmen. And we've seen men of Harad because they were in the book 4 of Lord of the Rings when Sam and Frodo saw the Oliphant when Faramir captured them.
Yeah, they were the Haradrim, right?
Right, right. So Haradwaith, Haradrim, same deal. Yeah. So they come. So basically, it seems like for a generation, they're sieging Umbar. And so the Gondorians, they lose every single bit of land around Umbar except the walled city itself, which is on the coast. So it's supported by Gondor's navy, so they don't lose it. So to me, one of the things that this sounded like, because there was actually two things, but I'll mention the other one later. This sounded like the Crusades to me, because for a while they conquered the whole of the Holy Land in, you know, Israel and basically up to modern day Syria. But the last thing that they had was the city of Acre, which I think is in modern day Syria. And the only reason that they held it out pretty long, but the only reason they even held it was because they had the sea support, because they had better boats. So that kind of sounds like this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Umbar, I believe it's a desert area. Like it's far enough south that it's like sandy, you know, like think like Morocco. Cause mm-hmm. that's probably geographically right about where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, by 1050, so 1050 of the Third Age, by land, Gondor brings another army to defeat the men of Harad. And so that victorious king, he takes the name. You take a stab. How do you pronounce that?
Hiarmendisil.
Hiarmendisil. So South Victor. So just like Scipio Africanus, we already had the East Victor. Now we got the South Victor.
Okay.
And so with this, this really is where Gondor's at the height of its power. All right. So you got Hiarmendisil, and his reign is 134 years. Remember, their lifespans are all longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's even dares to attack him. So now, if you got out the map, you want to read that description of how big Gondor is at this point?
In his day, Gondor reached the summit of its power. The realm then extended north to Celebrant and the southern eaves of Mirkwood, west to the Grey Flood, east to the inland Sea of Rune, south to the Riv Harnan, and thence along the coast to the peninsula and haven of Umbar. The men of the Vales of Anduin acknowledged its authority, and the kings of the Harad did homage to Gondor, and their sons lived as hostages in the court of its king. Mordor was desolate, but was watched over by great fortresses that guarded the passes.
Mm. All right, so was this the days of yore for Gondor? The zenith of its power?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, I would say certainly. Yes. Yeah, it's a little bit hard to tell because they talk about hostages and tribute, but I would say yes.
Well, it's kind of like we heard the same thing in Numenor, right? Like that even once the intellect and culture peaked, the military power and empire continued to build after that. That kind of sounds like what's going on here.
I agree. Besides that, I think this guy sounds like a little bit of a better dude. And mm-hmm. the only people that they say they're demanding tribute from is the Haradrim. And if it wasn't from them, if it wasn't from the good guys here, it would be from other evil people that would demand the tribute. So better them than somebody else. Maybe that's a weak excuse, but I don't think it's as bad as Numenor was.
Okay.
As far as the keeping hostages goes, obviously common practice in the ancient and medieval world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Though I would say, I think there's cases on record where this has gone bad. So again, to do another historical reference here, Philip of Macedon was the dad of...
Alexander the Great?
Yeah, nice. Okay. So I believe he was a hostage in Thebes when he was growing up. And so Thebes at that point, that was actually the most powerful Greek city at the time because Athens and Sparta, I think, had just fought a war against each other and they were pretty beat up. So I think Thebes was the most powerful at this time. And so basically when he was a hostage there, he learned exactly how they work militarily. And so he, knowing all of that, he then used those tactics, perfected them, knew what they were going to do, and then he conquered all of Greece once he became king. So it's like, so sometimes taking the hostages can backfire. Like he's an example of it, because then eventually, as soon as he dies, because he gets murdered somehow, Alexander takes over and then he goes and conquers all of Persia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the most, rightfully one of the most famous people in history. Let's see. Oh, they mentioned Mordor. Mordor was desolate but was watched over by great fortresses that guarded the passes. What's the most relevant Mordor watchtower we know?
Minas Ithil?
Not quite. No, because that's just this. I think that's actually just a straight up good guy city because Isildur built that.
What else? Gotcha. Okay. The tower where Frodo has been taken hostage.
Yeah, Cirith Ungol. Yep. Okay, so now we get fun. Now we get into the fun part. Hiarmendisil's son, Atanatar. All right. Hiarmendisil's son. I forgot how to say it.
Hiarmendisil's son, Atanatar.
Yeah. So he is the classic spoiled brat. You had the glorious. This is how I actually figured out or think that Hiyama Dassel was actually a good guy is because his son was actually crappy. There's like, well, hold on, let's read the line. But Anna Atananar loved ease and did nothing to maintain the power that he had inherited, and his two sons were of like temper. The waning of Gondor had already begun before he died and was doubtless observed by its enemies. How many times in history is the glorious king's son a complete beat-off? Like, how many times does that just happen over and over again? Like, what can every single billionaire's kids or powerful politician's kids suck? Reference to the current president. Why? Like, Clifford, do you have any ideas?
Well, I'd say they had nothing to fight for, and that screws them up from a young age.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so just as a reference too, if you read through Dante's whole Divine Comedy, the three parts, Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, there's one part, I forget which one it's in. I think it's in Purgatorio. But anyways, there's basically a whole canto, so it's a mini little chapter. A whole canto just basically about this subject. Like, how are the king's sons, all these great kings, how are their sons always so bad? And it's just, yeah, I mean, think of the billionaires, the sons, complete comfort from birth, you know, it's just, they don't have anything to live on. One example, this is a very random example, but, and I'm not blaming these people at all. This is like a good example of it. This is actually a made it example. But think about this. No Kenyan distance runner Olympian. None of their kids are good at running.
Interesting.
And the reason for that is because they've never run a day in their life. You know, their dad or their mom gets rich off of making a professional career of running. So then they have the wealth to buy a car and probably just fund the whole village, basically. And so then from there, it's like the kid just never needs to run in their life, you know? So they're used to the life of comfort. So they just don't know. And in that situation, it's like, yeah, you guys made it, like, congrats. But yeah, you don't ever see that as a generational thing. Whereas here, that probably would be more so, you know, not to say it's like guaranteed by any means, but yeah, that's more prevalent, I guess, affluent countries, I guess. But yeah. So what's the reasoning? Probably Hiyarman Dassel. He was probably too easy on his son, you know, because he was actually probably trying to provide all this, you know, he was trying to provide for the kingdom itself and he did a very good job. Excellent. This is the strength, greatest of the borders and everything. But then after that, he was probably too easy on his kid. Like, he didn't give his kid enough of a challenge because it's just like, dad takes care of everything. Dad's a rock star. You know, I don't want to it's hard to be in a shadow. How am I going to improve upon this? But he was never even probably challenged to improve upon it. Right. As I was thinking about this, we don't have to get into this, but as a big tangent, potentially, in a way, this is the whole millennial generation. Like, I think we go down as the most spoiled and pampered, and I don't know. We'll see. It's probably, I think it's already coming back to bite us, and I think it's going to get worse in the next.
Well, we've got Gen Z to rip on now, so.
No, see, I think they're going to be better than us. I think we're the worst.
Okay.
Okay, so then at this point, Gondor befriends some Northmen, and so they're very shady about who the Northmen are. So we're just going to keep running with it. Yeah, they'll be shady. Anyways, they live somewhere around where Beorn lives, if you remember from The Hobbit. So, like, right on the Anduin, in between Mirkwood and the Misty Mountains, right? And they were kin of the Lesser Men. Sorry, they were the nearest kin of Lesser Men. So this means those three houses that came over in the Silmarillion. They were probably like a fourth branch or like part of the families that didn't actually get to Beleriand. All right. So they're somehow related distantly to one of those.
Okay.
Anyways, Gondor lets them move to the fields at the south of Mirkwood. So I think that's probably the Gladen Fields itself, so that they can help defend against the Easterlings. Easterlings are the people of the East. Okay. Now, the Northmen weren't completely loyal to Gondor, partially because sometimes they were just kind of greedy or just acting in their self-interest. I don't know. You might not be able to blame them. depends on the situation. But anyways, these Easterlings attack again, and then King Minilcar, and this is in 1248, he leads a huge army east and destroys all of their armies and camps and settlements. All right, and he's another one that takes that Romandasil name, so the East Victor again.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you want to read that paragraph on 221?
His return, Romandasil fortified the west shore of Anduin as far as the inflow of the Limlight, and forbade any stranger to pass down the river beyond Emmonweal. He it was that built the pillars of the Argonauth at the entrance to Nenhithoel. But since he needed men and desired to strengthen the bond between Gondor and the Northmen, he took many of them into his service and gave to some high rank in his armies.
All right. So he's the one that built the Argonath. I thought Isildur and Anarion actually built that themselves, and they were super, super hubris. but I guess I was wrong. Thankfully, I was wrong on that one. So this guy's the one that builds it. Now they're friendly with the Northmen. And then Romandasil's son, Valakar, is sent to live with the Northmen for a while to get better acquainted. And he loves this people, and he marries the king's daughter. Okay? Mm. This is one of those classic stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Pocahontas things or something. So when the citizens of Gondor find out that Valakar married some barbarian's daughter, they were all shocked. You know, because if you look at all these Northmen's names that are in this thing, they mm-hmm. sound like German barbarians' names against
Roman. Yeah, I was going to say, this feels like this is some clear Roman
right.
and like Visigoth situation going right. on. Right?
Correct. Yep, absolutely.
Which I've actually, in keeping with that, like, you know a lot more about this than I do, but it's kind of like the traditional short story version is like, oh, the Vandals swept out of the north, literally vandalized
right.
or sacked Rome. And the end of Rome was just the arrival of these other people who destroyed it in very battle terms. But the longer form, as I've learned more about it, sounds a little bit more like there is a long, slow kind of bleed into Rome from the north.
Yeah, it was super slow. It was super slow.
And it was like some military action, some migration, some political exchange, and then even some just like casual intermarrying. And it was that process, you could see that process playing out here where, like, you know, political interactions done with good intentions slowly blur the edge of the kingdom, and then it comes to a head at some point.
Yeah, well, it's like Rome was, they mercenaried out their border protection, so they literally let the barbarians at the door be the ones in the kingdom so that they could fight the other barbarians at the door, you know, mm-hmm. which eventually became the Huns. Like, they were the worst.
Right.
Actually, we'll reference them too. But yeah, definitely what you're saying there. Now, some of these these Dunedain, like the actual heirs of Numenor, the people in Gondor, they were concerned that if he has a barbarian wife, is that going to ruin their bloodline? You know, because these people, the Numenoreans, they still have the longer bloodline. Like, they live to be 200, 300 years old, you know? Whereas the barbarian people, it's like they got the normal lifespan that we have, you know? So 80 to 100 years, right? So is marrying that going to screw it up? That's actually a valid concern, in my opinion. Not super valid that you don't do it, but it's something to consider, right?
Mm-hmm.
So lots of the people in Gondor, they were offended when the king's son goes and marries a barbarian woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a rebellion breaks out because all the people in the southern provinces, including the noble cousins down there, so the ones that have, like, king's blood and stuff, they didn't want the half-breed son, Eldakar, to become king. So Valakar had a son, Eldakar, and they don't... The royal cousins are like, nah, this kid's not legit. We're out, you know? So should we read the big story?
Sure.
Therefore, when Eldakar succeeded his father, there was war in Gondor. But Eldakar did not prove easy to thrust from his heritage. To the lineage of Gondor, he added the fearless spirit of the Northmen. He was handsome and valiant, and showed no sign of aging more swiftly than his father. When the Confederates, led by the descendants of the kings, rose against him, he opposed them to the end of his strength. At last, he was besieged in Osgiliath, and held it long, until hunger and the greater forces of the rebels drove him out, leaving the city in flames. In that siege and burning, the dome of Osgiliath was destroyed, and the Palantir was lost in the waters. But Eldekar eluded his enemies and came to the north, to his kinsfolk in Rivanion. Many gathered to him there, both of the Northmen in the service of Gondor and of the Dunedain of the northern parts of the realm, for many of the latter had learned to esteem him, and many more had came to hate his usurper. This was Castamir, grandson of Calamenter, younger brother of Ramandasil II. He was not only one of those nearest by blood to the crown, but he had the greatest following of all the rebels. He was the captain of ships, and was supported by the people of the coasts and of the grey havens of Pelagiar and Umbar. Castamir had not long sat upon the throne before he proved himself haughty and ungenerous. He was a cruel man, as he had first shown in the taking of Osgiliath. He caused Ornendel, son of Eldekar, who was captured, to be put to death. And the slaughter and destruction done in the city at his bidding far exceeded the needs of war. This was remembered in Minas Anor and in Ithilien. And there, love for Castamir was further lessened when it became seen that he cared little for the land, and thought only of the fleets, and purposed to remove the king's seat to Pelagiar.
Thus he had been king only 10 years, when Eldekar, seeing his time, came with a great army out of the north, and folk flocked to him from Kelnardon and Anorion and Ithilien. There was a great battle in Lebanon at the crossings of Eruri, in which much of the best blood in Gondor was shed. Eldegor himself slew Castamir in combat, and so was avenged for Ornendil. But Castamir's sons escaped, and with others of their king and many people of the fleets, they held out long at Pelargir. When they had gathered there all the force they could, for Eldekar had no ships to beset them by sea, they sailed away and established themselves at Umbar. There they made a refuge for all the enemies of the king and a lordship independent of his crown. Umbar remained at war with Gondor for many lives of men, a threat to its coastlands and to all traffic on the sea. It was never again completely subdued until the days of Elisar, and the region of South Gondor became a debatable land between the corsairs and the kings.
All right, wow. That's a big deal.
Yeah. So full-on rebellion.
Civil war, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a ton of the true line or whatever, the Dunedain, get killed.
Yeah, well, I mean, and half of them go betrayed. They're the ones that are starting the rebellion, you know?
Uh-huh.
So this is the Kinstrife stuff. If you ever hear about it, this is what they're talking about. So first of all, Eldekar's half-breed status didn't actually diminish the length of life for these people. So, you know, the legitimate concern, all right, didn't actually have to be worried. He was actually better off because he had the northern ferocity, you know, that Tolkien loves so much. He brought that in. Mm-hmm. Okay. His uncle's the usurper, and despite the, maybe it's his second cousin uncle or something, but anyways, mm-hmm. despite the noble blood, he proves to be an asshole, you know, just mm-hmm. just as we saw in Numenor multiple times from all their kings, right? This is another mini version of that. This, you know, Osgiliath, they destroy the crown jewel palace of the city, basically, in this war. And even the Palantir there as well. So, I mean, this is just, it's not like they lose those with War to Mordor. It's like, no, civil war is what ruined it, right? Mm-hmm. And then this is how they lose Umbar. It's not by invasion. It's not by, you know, the men of the south taking it over or anything, or Sauron influencing him to take it over. It's just, no, these are the rebels. This is what they claim is the rival capital, just as the bad Numenorians did of old, you know? So obviously any sort of civil war thing, lots of examples in history, American Civil War. I find that one a depressing subject. I don't understand why people like studying that one. Like, I understand
the American Civil War.
Yeah, I understand, like, the love for World War II. Like, I get that one. Like, studying World War II, it's like, oh, yeah, that's sick. But
mm-hmm.
I don't really get it for the Civil War.
Yeah, no, I feel that.
You got other examples? Because I got more.
Of the Civil War?
Civil War examples in history that you thought of when you read this part. Or any sort mm-hmm. of, or any sort of really strife, you know, like kind of family on family. I mean, there's countless, really, but...
Yeah, not off the top of my head.
Okay, so the other ones I was thinking about was there was some sort of short English Civil War, and then looped into that a couple generations later was the Glorious Revolution. And that was like they killed the one king because they just hated him, but they still made his son king. Like, you know, I got to reacquaint myself with it because I didn't understand this at all. It's just you killed the one king in a war because you hated that guy himself because of the way he ruled, which is like, well, all right, okay. And then you made his son king. That's where I don't get it. I could get you,
like,
get
old habits die hard.
Right. I could get you get a new king, but no, you just take the son over. What are you talking about? You know? And then
I think that, like, a lot of those situations when they pick a new king, though, if there's no lineage, stuff falls apart. Like, that's when something like someone else immediately takes power after, or there's like a military uprising of some sort.
Yeah, kind of. But hold on. But two generations later, they kick out the one son because he converts to Catholicism. And by this point, they were already all Protestants, and they outright kick him out. So, like, the other guy that they bring in, some Dutch guy who I think that's the William of Orange guy who doesn't. Or the Oliver Cromwell guy, whatever. All those names, those kinds of people. They're the ones that come in, and it's just, oh, come on. What? You know, so they do, at points, they have just kicked out and basically quasi started a new line, you know, like where the true heir is still there, you know, like it's still inhabited. They're just not on the throne. Mm-hmm. Something that we'll return to in The Return of the King. So, FYI, foreshadowing. Other thing I thought about with this kin strife stuff, if you think about medieval Europe as a whole, it was all Christian, right? And then then the Reformation happens and the Protestants and the Catholics are all fighting with each other. So that's kind of the 30 Years' War, like the War of Religions. I kind of felt like this was applicable there, like the, you know, the Civil War strife. Because as the Catholics and Protestants fight, who's on the margins? It's like all the Islamic territories, you know, and they're just, you know, encroaching further and further into Europe. And it's just like, I don't know, guys, you guys got a problem if you want to fight that off too. Kind of like how Gondor's enemies are waiting in the wings as soon as they, you know, see all this.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst civil war I have ever heard of takes the cake for me. It has to be one of the most depressing subjects in all of history. Peloponnesian War. Oh my gosh, that one blew.
I don't know much about it at all. All
right, so this is the Peloponnesia. That's the part of Greece that sticks out furthest below. So that's where Sparta's on. It's on that. So generation before, they all came together and they fought off the Persians twice. They all these city states that never really liked each other, they came together to fight off Persia because they did at least understand that we got some sort of Greek identity because we at least share the same language, right? And basically we have the same religious beliefs. But anyways, within a generation of that, Athens and Sparta, they're at each other's throats. Athens has the best navy, Sparta has the best army, and a war breaks out, and basically it's an off and on war, but it takes 30 years. And how it starts off was Athens, they figured, all right, we'll just hide out in the city because they won't be able to storm the city. And then we got the sea powers because we're connected to the coast, so we can just have the navy back us up. So we'll be fine because we got all our colonies and everything. And so as soon as they do that, Sparta comes, sieges the city, and then a plague hits the city itself and wipes out like a third of the people, including their best leader of all time, Pericles. And it's just, oh, man. And then after that, it's just every single stroke is just downhill, downhill, downhill. Like, you know, they all send like huge armies out to one of the far-flung provinces in Sicily. And all of it is just basically they both each die. You know, like everybody just gets wiped out. It's just, oh, man. Like you're reading about that and you're just, oh, this is such a bummer. And this is like Socrates is alive at this time too. Like, I think originally for at least maybe a little bit, he was actually a soldier, and then he's too old, so he's just walking around Athens questioning everybody. And so Plato's probably like an adolescent. There's a Xenophon guy. He's got a famous history. He was, I believe, an Athenian general, but he actually got exiled because he screwed up at some point, and so then he just starts becoming a historian for the war. And so, you know, like, it's one of those wars where Sparta, it technically won, but there really wasn't a real winner because everybody mm-hmm. lost so much in this. And it was just, you know, Greece just divided itself. And, like, there's always the Persian threat further off, too. And it's just, you know, like, one of the things that comes out of it is Athens loses, so their scapegoat is Socrates. So that's where he goes on trial, and then he has to drink the hemlock, you know. That is part of this, yeah.
Did not know that. Okay.
Yeah. Quite the bummer, but that's what I was thinking of, you know, when I'm hearing about Civil War and stuff. All right, after the kin strife, there's not much Numenorean blood around. So now the Dunedain start often to intermarry lesser men.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read this mingling quote?
This mingling did not at first hasten the waning of the Dunedain, as had been feared, but the waning still proceeded little by little as it had before. For no doubt it was due above all to Middle-earth itself, and to the slow withdrawing of the gifts of the Numenoreans after the downfall of the Land of the Star. Eldikar lived to his 235th year, and was king for 58 years, of which 10 were spent in exile.
Okay. All right, so then after that, a couple
of
generations...
Wait, real quick. Land of the Star, was that Numenor?
Yes, because okay. The island was shaped like a five-pointed star.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So in other words, after Numenor itself was destroyed, the Numenoreans are kind of losing special status slowly by slowly,
yeah.
bit by bit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So a couple generations of peace after that. So that kind of means, you know, if there's ever a couple generations of peace, I think the guy that brought about that peace, he was a good guy. So the Hayarmundasil and then this Eldikar guy, they get thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
So then, anyways, but we get to Telemnar, the 26th king. So we're about 1600 of the Third Age. His father was slain in battle with the Corsairs of Umber. Then the deadly plague came with dark winds out of the east. This king and all his family is wiped out. Lots of Gondor too, especially near Osgiliath, you know, in a city. It's obviously how it works. Then, for weariness and fewness of men, the watches on the borders of Mordor ceased, and the fortresses that guarded the passes unmanned. Oh, boy.
Bad news.
All right, so obviously plagues, bubonic plague. There's a huge plague that struck Byzantium, I think in the rule of Justinian, which was their best emperor. He was one that could have potentially reunified the Eastern and fallen Western Empire, but this plague struck, and it's just, what are you going to do when half, like a fifth of your population's wiped out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, look at how coronavirus with the less than 1% hit rate devastated us, you know?
So, right.
But still, abandoning the guard on Mordor, come on. How many guys does it actually take to have to just keep watch? You don't even have to walk around. Just keep watch, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking that it's kind of it's like a generational thing. Like, they probably start forgetting after a couple generations of peace. After, you know, and this is many, many generations since anything's gone down at Mordor.
Yeah.
They're starting to be like, wait, why are we even doing this again? There's nobody here.
That's a good idea, yeah.
They start losing people, and then it's like, oh, we can't really staff all of our bases. Well, you know, let's just defend what we can, and then do we really need outposts far away, et cetera? It's like that type of thing. And it's, I could imagine it turns into, like, nobody's like, oh, I think it's a great idea to remove these guards. It's just like, oh, if we only have, you know, this much military, how thin can we spread it?
Yeah, that's where my mind went, was extremely contemporary history where, you know, is America the world police? You know, do we have to have guys in the Middle East everywhere, every single country, you know? So that's what I thought about. All right, so enemies of Gondor, they suffer in the plague too, but this is when Greenwood really starts to become Mirkwood. So before it was Mirkwood, the whole huge forest was just called the Greenwood. But yeah, so Mirkwood, much scarier name, right? We saw it in The Hobbit. Plague was potentially devised by Sauron for the express purposes of opening up Mordor again. So that was his goal, was to get them to just demon it, you know, unguard it. So you want to read the King Telemachar or Telemnar?
When,
When King Telemnar died, the White Tree of Minas Anor also withered and died, but Tirandor, his nephew, who succeeded him, replanted a seedling in the citadel. He it was who removed the king's house permanently to Minas Anor, for Esgiliath was now partly deserted and began to fall into ruin. Few of those who had fled from the plague into Ithilien or to the western dales were willing to return. Tirandor, coming young to the throne, had the longest reign of all the kings of Gondor, but he couldn't achieve little more than the reordering of his realm within and the slow nursing of its strength. But Telumetar, his son, remembering the death of Minardil, and being troubled by the insolence of the corsairs, who raided his coasts even as far as the Anfalas, gathered his forces and in 1810 took Umbar by storm. In that war, the last descendants of Castamir perished, and Umbar was again held for a while by the kings. Telumetar added to his name the title Umbar Dasil. But in the new evils that soon befell Gondor, Umbar was again lost and fell into the hands of the men of Harad.
All right. So, White Tree died.
Bad news.
Well, conveniently, it was when the new line of kings started. So that might be more than a coincidence. But new tree was planted. Esgiliath finally abandoned. Rebel Gondorians and Umbar finally defeated, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now the decline can really be felt. Now we're in it. Okay, so we just had the kin strife, and then, you know, we're not at all close to even the Northern Kingdom, which we'll get into more. There's a plague. So all of this, to bring this all the way back to what started this mini season of specials, man specials, Faramir's long, broad stroke speech with Frodo and Sam about the history of Gondor and its decay. So I basically referenced it there, but in that episode, I hint at that, you know, this potential decline of Gondor can kind of be analogous overall, if anything, to most, decline of Christian Europe.
Okay.
All right. And so, you know, there's some sort of idea that, like, when you read Faramir's words there, you get that feeling. For sure. Or at least I get it because, I don't know, maybe I relate to it better or something. Or I don't know. I was born in the tradition that would fit.
Mm-hmm.
You get the feeling that he was born in the wrong age. You know, like he should have lived under Hamayar Dasil, or he should have been under Eldakar. You know, like if he was Hamayar Dasil's son, he actually probably would have been lazy in all reality. But, you know, potentially he would, if he was like a cousin or something, it's like, oh. You know, he was actually the same person. It's like, oh, he wouldn't have let them be lazy for the next couple of generations. Or if he was under Eldakar, it's like, oh, he would have been perfect there. You know, like he would have been fighting right alongside him. Would have been like one of his top generals or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because after the kin strife, after the plague, after the next invasions that are to come that we're about to go over, after the death of the last king, you know, this place is weak and it's a shadow of its former self. And so that's kind of. When I was thinking about all this, it's like, well, that's kind of like Christendom, you know, which was basically Europe, but it was even, for a while, it was even like all of the Roman Empire, like the whole Mediterranean basin. But, you know, then eventually the Orthodox East breaks off because they hate the Pope. The Protestant Reformation happens, wars of religion, Muslim invasions, colonial squabbles between the actual Catholic powers. You know, Reformation thinkers give way to Enlightenment thinkers. Enlightenment thinkers give way to, you know, the secular materialist atheist thinkers. Then by that point, they're trying to replace the whole, the Christian whole in all of their thought with something else. And it's just, I mean, all of it kind of fails, which is what the 20th century reflects, right? But, you know, it's still though, in Tolkien's time, there was still a church, you know, there was still some sort of like last gasp of Christian Europe or something. And then even still like today, like there's still a church and everything, but it's kind of limping on compared to what it was when, you know, with all the great European monarchs of, you know, the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, I would say. And again, what I referenced there when we were talking about the Faramir speech, it was like, you know, Europe today, they have all these super awesome, cool cathedrals. You might debate, but it's like potentially, at least in the running for the pinnacle of architecture, right? You know, I mean, it's just like, and then they're just museums now. It's not like, you know, like the descendants still live there, but they're just basically museums. You know, I mean, it's there's a fraction of people that still think of them as the cathedrals that their ancestors built and stuff. But it's just to think that these people were so excited to actually build these, even though it would take multiple lifetimes. And it's like, well, now the descendants is like, all right, they can barely fill it up if they're lucky. So that's kind of, if you read this whole thing in that context, like the decay of Gondor in that context from the Faramir context, it's like, phew. This is more than just the point for point historical annal, you know?
Right, right.
Just something to keep in mind.
No, absolutely. That was a great description. That paints a strong picture.
Yeah, hopefully. All right, should we keep going though? Okay. All right. So now we got to deal with the Wayne Riders that come out of the East for the next century. So I looked it up. A Wayne is a cart.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't really know. I kind of just, they said chieftains fought in chariots. I kind of just assume they're all chariots. So anyways, what does that sound like? Somebody that uses Waynes, if they're going to use a cart, they got what? What's involved with that?
Horses.
Right. Okay. So what is a horse? What is this? What do these people sound like?
The Huns or something.
Right. Anything that comes out of the East. Huns, Mongols.
Yeah.
And then you could even extend it to Native Americans on the plains, even though they didn't have horses until the Europeans, wild ones got away, you know?
Okay.
So when you're thinking of, well, I think it was in Guns, Germs, and Steels. I think it was that book that pointed out like the Central Asian plains just lend themselves to just any sort of horse people invaders, you know, like the most famous is the Mongols, but then there was the Huns before them at the end of Rome. Right. But the chariot aspect of it, that reminds me of the way back. That was like the Hittite people. They went against the Egyptians way, way back. And they came from the Russian steppe. So steppe, I think, just means plains
or that far away.
Yeah. Okay. Like they, or Ukraine, you know, like they migrated around the Black Sea to Turkey or modern day Turkey. It used to be called Asia Minor, you know.
Okay.
But so like, I don't know. I'm thinking of all those people when I hear these Wayne Riders, you know. And again, this is just to highlight. There's multiple examples for every single thing that we're referencing, right? This is where Tolkien, he's just got a bunch of different things in his head. And it's like, if it's going to be real, it should have something like this, right? And it's like, yep, you nailed it. Hit it out of the park. It has all this stuff in it. Even in Appendix A, when the story is complete. So, all the east of Gondor above Mordor was lost when these people invade. Eastern border now pushed back to the Anduin. It's supposed the Ringwraiths re-entered Mordor in this period, now that Gondor didn't have any presence further than, like, Ithilien. It's at this point, while the Wayne Riders attack Gondor in the east, Angmar attacks Arnor in the north. I think that had already started, but so be it. That's what this thing says. And then you want to read that thing in the mid-paragraph?
It was in the reign of Arafant in the north and of Andahur, son of Calimetar, in the south, that the two kingdoms again took counsel together after long silence and estrangement. For at last they perceived that some single power and will was directing the assault from many quarters upon the survivors of Numenor. It was at that time that Arvedui, heir of Arafant, wedded Firiel, daughter of Andahur, in 1940. But neither kingdom was able to send help to the other, for Angmar renewed its attack upon Arthedain at the same time as the Wayne Riders reappeared in great force.
Okay. That's good. All right, so...
Full court press from what we assume is a revived Sauron.
Well, but you can expect that from evil, right?
Right.
You know, so what I found more interesting was these two kingdoms, same descendants, you know, they all recognize Elendil as their head. They had not been in contact for a while. Right. So again, that sounds like, because it's actually so hard to imagine. And so that's why it's like, I can listen to this kind of stuff all day because it's so hard to imagine. But this is what happened with the Western and Eastern Roman empires. All right. So like the Eastern Roman Empire, it never actually fell. It became the Byzantium Empire. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, we call it Byzantium. They called themselves Romans until it fell in 1453, okay? Whereas the West was overrun by Germans and barbarians. And so literally it became like almost just like a language divide. There just was no – there just finally ended no contact for like hundreds of years. And then by that point, the languages were so different that in Italy, nobody could speak Greek. Like even Thomas Aquinas, who's the greatest, smartest saint of all time, probably – potentially smartest human being that ever lived, he at best knew broken Greek, like, you know, because he lived in the 1200s Italy. But, you know, by the Renaissance, that's part of the reason the Renaissance really gets going, is because it gets going after the Constantinople in the East falls to the and becomes Istanbul today. All the Greek scholars, they got out in time and they all came to Italy, you know, and so they had all the Greek texts and stuff. And so it's like, well, now we can start the Renaissance, you know, like that's how that happened. But it's like, it's shocking. Like they didn't even have the Odyssey and the Iliad. Like they kind of knew what happened, but they couldn't read it. Like for all of the Middle Ages, they couldn't read it. It's just, it's crazy to think that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's kind of weird that it would seem like these descendants, you know, they're related to each other.
Mm-hmm.
These two kingdoms don't talk, but it's like, well, again, this happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see.
They marry back together, basically. Right.
Well, yeah. So that's kind of interesting, too. There was at one point in like the darkest of dark ages. So like the darkest of dark ages is like when Rome's falling in late 400s. And then all the way through basically like 700s, it's really dark because it's just Germans that can't write. So like we don't know anything. That's what I mean by dark, at least when I say it. But then finally it starts to get going again with Charlemagne, because he's like the first Holy Roman Empire. You know, if you had like a world history class or Western Civ class or something in high school, you'll have heard the name Charlemagne, right? But he almost married the Byzantium emperor's daughter. And it's like, if he had done that, I don't think they did, but I can't quite remember. But if he had done that, it's like, oh, talk about good move to reunite East and West. Like, almost did it. But the next closest that they come is when the Crusaders all kind of work together because they all go East. But yeah, let's see what keeps happening here with these Wayne Riders and stuff. Do you want to take the next thing?
Many of the Wayne Riders now passed south of Mordor and made alliance with men of Khand and of Nir Harad. And in this great assault from the north and south, Gondor came near to destruction. In 1944, King Andaher and both his sons, Artemir and Faramir, fell in battle north of Morannon, and the enemy poured into Ithilien. But Eärnil, captain of the southern army, won a great victory in south Ithilien and destroyed the army of Harad that had crossed the river Poros. Hastening north, he gathered to him all that he could of the retreating northern army and came up against the main camp of the Wayne Riders, while they were feasting and reveling, believing that Gondor was overthrown and that nothing remained but to take the spoil. Eärnil stormed the camp and set fire to the Wanes and drove the army in a great rout out of Ithilien. A great part of those who fled before him perished in the dead marshes.
All right, so another one. There's historical example of this too. Like this is the most nuts one. So what you just read there was, you know where Mordor is. Everything east, it's all just basically bad men. So the bad men coordinated together to attack from the north of Mordor, attack Gondor, and from the south of Gondor, attack Gondor. Okay, you with me?
Mm-hmm.
So this actually happened. So in the 5th century, Rome's really being, you know, runoff, and so this is when the Huns are the chief problem, like the famous Attila the Hun Huns. I don't know if this might be like a generation before Attila, but whatever. So they were low-key super super well organized, and they could cover unbelievable distances like that. Okay, and so their kind of home base at this point was kind of modern day Ukraine, so at the top of the Black Sea. And so at one point they successfully coordinated attacking the Roman Empire on both sides of the Black Sea. Like they had people scaling the Caucasus Mountains in the south to go into basically what's modern day Armenia and Turkey. Mm-hmm. And then they also had people going through like Romania, Bulgaria today. And it's like, oh my gosh. And Rome was like just in a cluster already. And then it's just, wait, you're telling me they're attacking over here and over here? Like, how are we supposed to stop that?
That's wild.
Yeah, I mean, I know, but it's like, you get what I'm saying when Tolkien just kind of has these references in his head, and it's like, oh man, look at what Gondor has to face there. It's like, yeah, we've seen it. All right, but now there's this long section about reuniting the kingdoms. I know it's long, but I think it's worth the read. And again, this is where like we start to get the most narrative bit of this thing. So I don't know, it's kind of worth it. Okay. How about I start, and then I'll pass it off to you halfway through. All right. On the death of Odahar and his sons, Arvedui of the Northern Kingdom claimed the crown of Gondor as the direct descendant of Isildur and as the husband of Furiel, the only surviving child of Odahar, remember, because of the marriage between the two kingdoms. The claim was rejected. In this, Palendur, the steward of King Odahar, played the chief part. The Council of Gondor answered, "The crown and royalty of Gondor belong solely to the heirs of Melendil, son of Anarion, to whom Isildur relinquished his realm." So Anarion was Isildur's brother. "In Gondor, this heritage is reckoned through the sons only, and we have not heard that the law is otherwise in Arnor, as in the daughter can't succeed. It's only the sons." To this, Avardui replied, "Elendil had two sons, of whom Isildur was the elder and the heir of his father. We have heard that the name of Elendil stands to this day at the head of the lines of the kings of Gondor, since he was accounted the high king of all the lands of the Dunedain when Elendil still lived. The conjoined rule in the south was committed to his sons, but when Elendil fell, Isildur departed to take up the high kingship of his father and committed the rule in the south in like manner to the son of his brother. He did not relinquish his royalty in Gondor, nor intend that the realm of Elendil should be divided forever. Moreover, in Numenor, of old, the scepter descended to the eldest child of the king, whether man or woman. It is true that the law has not been observed in the lands of exile ever troubled by war, but such was the law of our people, to which we now refer, seeing that the sons of Odahar died childless."
To this, Gondor made no answer. The crown was claimed by Arnil, the victorious captain, and it was granted to him with the approval of all the Dunedain and Gondor, since he was of the royal house. He was the son of Cirion-dil, son of Calamasiel, son of Ar-Kirias, brother of Narmad-Sil II. Arvedui did not press his claim, for he had neither the power nor the will to oppose the choice of the Dunedain of Gondor, yet the claim was never forgotten by his descendants, even when their kinship passed away. For the time was now drawing near when the North Kingdom would come to an end. Arvedui was indeed the last king, as his name signifies. It is said that this name was given to him at his birth by Malbeth the Seer, who said to his father, "Arvedui you shall call him, for he will be the last of the Arthedain. Though a choice will come to the Dunedain, and if they take the one that seems less hopeful, then your son will change his name and become king of a great realm. If not, then much sorrow and many lives of men shall pass until the Dunedain arise and are united again." In Gondor, also one king only followed Arnil. It may be that if the crown and the scepter had been united, then the kingship would have been maintained and much evil averted. But Arnil was a wise man and not arrogant, even if, as to most men in Gondor, the realm of Arthedain seemed a small thing for all the lineage of its lords. He sent messages to Arvedui announcing that he had received the crown of Gondor according to the laws and the needs of the South Kingdom. "But I do not forget the royalty of an Arnor, nor deny our kinship, nor wish that the realms of Elendil should be estranged. I will send to your aid when you have need, so far as I am able." It was, however, long before Arnil felt himself sufficiently secured to do as he promised. King Arafant continued with dwindling strength to hold off the assaults of Angmar, and Arvedui, when he succeeded, did likewise. But at last, in the autumn of 1973, messages came to Gondor that Arthedain was in great straits, and that the Witch King was preparing a last stroke against it. Then Arnil sent his son Arnur north with a fleet, as swiftly as he could, and with as great strength as he could spare. Too late. Before Arnur reached the havens of Lindon, the Witch King had conquered Arthedain, and Arvedui had perished.
All right. A lot there. All right, thoughts?
Okay, so attempt to unify the kingdoms, right?
Yeah.
They
yeah.
disagree and
resolve what do you think of the legal stuff? Who do you think should have been king? Do you think Arvedui's claim was legit to claim both kingdoms? Because he was a Sealdor's heir?
This is where it gets, it's like...
Right.
They both have... I you see how this stuff comes up in history. Like, both of them have a decent case.
Right. This really actually helps really understand it for people that read history. I feel like I
err on the side of supporting the other guy. Arnail.
I think Arvedui's kid should be the one that's... The son should be the one that's the uniter of both the realms.
Okay.
But yeah.
Wait, sorry. I might have.
No, I think you had it right.
Oh, 1 second. Oh, no. Okay. Sorry. I misprocessed something for a second. No, I forgot that that Arvedui had married.
Right. That's why I think.
Onto her daughter. I thought that it was the other way around.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Arvedui has a stronger claim, I would say, to both.
I don't think he has a stronger claim to both. I think his son has a stronger claim to both.
Yes.
Because he would be the grandson of the former king of Gondor, and that king died without an heir besides him, the grandson, you know?
Right, okay. I changed what I said. Arvedui has a stronger claim. I think he should have taken both. I think he made a good case that... He had a stronger case, I think, all around.
Yeah.
And he should have claimed the whole kingdom. And everyone should have agreed that that was supposed to happen all along.
Right, and
aside from direct lineages, the unification was a good thing. Would have been a good thing.
Right, well, I mean, that was prophesied, too. This Malbeth the Seer...
Mm-hmm.
Arvedui you shall call him, for he shall be the last in Arathane, though his choice will come to the Dunedain, and if they take the one that seems less hopeful, then your son will change his name and become king of a great realm. So it's like, they just missed out on uniting it, and then disaster comes for both of them. Because mm-hmm. Arvedui, yeah, we already read his story. He's the last king of Arnor, and then Gondor... The kings, they're not going to last much longer here.
Mm-hmm. He's the guy who got crushed in the ice, right?
Yep. And real life stuff, it's like, I don't know. I think, again, it's north and south in this story, but then I think in real life it's east and west. There was the Pope in Rome and there was the Patriarch in Constantinople, and they started feuding about who's, not really who's more important, but who has authority to do what. Mm-hmm. And so then they both just... finally excommunicated each other in what was known as the Great Schism, you know? And so then it's like, well, that's the official divide of East and West. And it just got more permanent and permanent throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
There was that point where Charlemagne almost a couple hundred years before almost united East and West, but nope. And then even in the Crusades, like part of the intention was to try to heal that divide, but then they mostly just made it worse. Like heavily. So yeah, I don't know. Just, and anywhere you look in history, like divisions like this is just, this is always problematic. So,
mm-hmm.
All right. But Iarnil, they still stay in friendship. So this is kind of cool. And so he sends his son Iarnor with an army and a fleet up north. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that must have been, I imagine that's a cool scene. Like the king, you know, he calls his son into the court to commission him to go. And it's just, all right, you know, hey, our distant kin in the north, they're in trouble. Finally, we have some breathing room. I want you to go with all speed to their aid, you know, and don't fail us. You know, don't screw this up. And then the son probably just, like, you know, gets super pumped up. He walks out mm-hmm, really swiftly mm-hmm. to organize all his fleets to go, you know, because he's got to book it. And it's just, you know, thinking, oh, this is my chance. This is my chance to not just impress dad, but also show that I'm going to be the next great king of Gondor. I'm going to be one to... go down in the history books and stuff. So this Iarnor guy, he comes to the Grey Havens, and it's a splendid Gondor army. He teams up with Círdan, and they go to battle against the Witch King, who's set up at Fornost, right? Remember, because Arvedui, he fled north because the Witch King was in Fornost. So then the Witch King, he thought his army, you know, he thought this army would be easy to break. You know, it would be a layup of a battle, right? Kind of like all the others before. But What does it say? But the host of the West came down on him out of the hills of Evendom, and there was a great battle on the plains of Nunil and the North Downs. The forces of Angmar were already giving way and retreating towards Fornost when the main body of the horsemen that had passed around the hills came down from the north and scattered them in a great rout. Then the Witch King, with all that he could gather from the wreck, fled northwards, seeking his own land of Angmar. Before he could gather the shelter of Carnadum, the cavalry of Gondor overtook him, with Iarnor riding at their head. At the same time, a force under Glorfindel, the elf lord, came out of Rivendell. Then so utterly was Angmar defeated that not a man nor an orc of that realm remained west of the mountains.
But it is said that when all was lost, suddenly the Witch King himself appeared, black-robed and black-masked upon a black horse. Fear fell upon all who beheld him. But he singled out the captain of Gondor for the fullness of his hatred, and with a terrible cry he rode straight upon him. Arnor would have withstood him, but his horse could not endure that onset, and it swerved and bore him far away before he could master it. Then the Witch King laughed, and none that heard it ever forgot the horror of that cry. But Glorfindel rode up then on his white horse, and in the midst of his laughter the Witch King turned to flight and passed into the shadows. For night came down on the battlefield, and he was lost, and none saw whither he went. Arnor now rode back, but Glorfindel, looking into the gathering dark, said, "Do not pursue him. He will not return to this land. Far off yet is his doom, and not by the hand of men will he fall." These words many remembered, but Arnor was angry, desiring only to be avenged for his disgrace. So ended the evil realm of Angmar, and so did Arnor, captain of Gondor, earn the chief hatred of the Witch King. But many years were still to pass before that was revealed.
All right, so Witch King defeated by the Gondor army in the north, even as the Arnor kings were finally defeated, or finally lost forever. Basically the same generation, but still Gondor did actually clear it out. So this is when the people in the Shire, like the hobbits in the Shire, they get room, you know, breathing room, and they're kind of just left to their own devices, right? Because there's no more king anymore. So, like, they win this great victory in the north, but then presumably this Gondor army just leaves south afterwards because it's like, well, now there's nothing left.
Right,
So, but that one line from and this is the Glorfindel that we saw in Lord of the Rings, obviously. And so, yeah, he has that one line there. Far off yet is his doom, as in the Witch Kings. Not by the hand of man will he fall. Foreshadowing. Yeah, so Iarnor, he seemed like a kind of a cool guy. We're about to finish off with him too, but yeah, so he goes back to Gondor, and then yeah, so let's see. So Witch King, apparently from there, he basically beelines it from Angmar to Mordor, and Gondor, apparently they're actually aware of it. So in the year 2000, the Ringwraiths and a bunch of other evil forces, they pass over Cirith Ungol and they take over Minas Ithil. And it quickly becomes Minas Morgul, which is the place of dread. Okay, so this is apparently when the town's been taken over. So I guess for 2,000 years, it was actually a good guy place. But then quickly, as soon as the Ringwraiths get there, it's like, all right, this is going to be bad. This is going to be real bad. And this is when people start to book it out of Ithilien. Like, this is where they slowly leave Ithilien, which Frodo and Sam walk through for a couple chapters there. But anyways, we got this last section here about Iarnor, what happens to him. You want to start it off?
Sure. Iarnor was a man like his father in valor, but not in wisdom. He was a man of strong body and hot mood, but he would take no wife, for his only pleasure was in fighting or in the exercise of arms. His prowess was such that none in Gondor could stand against him in those weapon sports in which he delighted, seeming rather a champion than a captain or king, and retaining his vigor and skill to a later age than was usual. When Arnor received the crown in 2043, the king of Minas Morgul challenged him to single combat, taunting him that he had not dared to stand before him in the battle in the north. For that time, Mardil the Steward restrained the wrath of the king. Minas Anur, which had become the chief city of the realm since the days of King Teleminar, and the residence of the kings, was now renamed Minas Tirith, as the city ever on guard against the evil of Morgul. Excuse me. Iarnor had held the crown only 7 years when the Lord of Morgul repeated his challenge, taunting the king that to the faint heart of his youth he had now added the weakness of age. Then Mardiel could no longer restrain him, and he rode with a small escort of knights to the gate of Minas Morgul. None of that riding were ever heard of again. It is believed in Gondor that the faithless enemy had trapped the king and that he had died in torment in Minas Morgul. But since there were no witnesses of his death, Mardiel the good steward ruled Gondor in his name for many years.
Now the descendants of the kings had become few. Their number had been greatly diminished in the kin strife, whereas since that time the kings had become jealous and watchful of those near kin. Often on those whom suspicion fell had fled to Umbar, and there joined the rebels, while others had renounced their lineage and taken wives not of Numenorean blood. So it was that no claimant to the crown could be found who was of pure blood, or whose claim all would allow, and all feared the memory of the kinstrife, knowing that if any such dissension arose again, then Gondor would perish. Therefore, though the years lengthened, the steward continued to rule Gondor, and the crown of Elendil lay in the lap of the king of Yarnil in the houses of the dead, where Yarnur had left it. Whew! And with that, we saw the end of both kingdoms, or the king's parts of both kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
That should be a good place to stop for tonight. What do you think of that, Clifford?
Yeah, sounds good.
I don't know. Pretty cool. Learn anything new? Favorite parts?
The historical comparisons are really cool. Frankly, even though I was aware of some of this stuff before, seeing the kingdoms like swell and contract over time.
Yeah.
Independent of like the larger arc of the Silmarillion and what the elves are up to is pretty cool to see.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it made sense in the north because I think it was smaller to begin with, but then it's also just when you get overrun by war after war with these people, then it's just, oh, there really is just nothing left here. It's a fraction of the population that was there before, you know? Mm-hmm. Like you start to kind of get that vibe, at least the vibe. If not, you can kind of piece it together yourself based on what you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, this was a pretty wide reaching. I'm sure I have divided this into two episodes by now. I think we got one more thing to do between this and Return of the King, but then after that we'll get on to Return of the King. I guess I'll say it now too. What we got to do is there's one last thing that needs to be linked up. First of all, we should at least study what the stewards did in the absence of the kings in Gondor. Mm-hmm. But then also, how did they become friends with Rohan?
Okay.
All right.
Cool.
And with that, I think we can leave it here.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, y'all.